of the Criminal Calendar. I'm really pleased to welcome back after 4 years, I think it's 4 years, Rita Mae Brown. Hi.
Hi.
And Phoenix really has changed in the last 4 years, according to your flight in, huh?
It's on steroids. It's just growing.
Did you recognize any of our famous landmarks, like Camelback Mountain?
I did. Well, that'll never change, and it's so beautiful.
It's really different there from the part of the world that you were in. I was just saying to Rita Mae that I always think, because I spent 20 years of my life where she lives, that the mountains here are like the skeletons of the mountains that you're used to.
I think that's a wonderful way to put it. And yet, and like all mountains, though, there's a magic to them. There's a spirituality, and you really feel it. You particularly feel it here.
It's interesting, because really the Appalachians are the oldest. I think geologically, it's, in terms of the rock, they're the oldest chain of mountains, and a couple of people have made a case, I think Sharon McCrum, that that chain goes on and reappears in Ireland and Scotland. There's some kind of a mineral belt in the mountains that you can trace, across the Atlantic and up into the rest of it. But what I miss and what I think is tragic that you and I will never see are the chestnut trees.
You know, it's funny you bring that up, because I'm on a search for old chestnut rails.
Wonderful.
You can still find them in old farms that have fallen down, on their upper, so to speak, in West Virginia or whatever, and the old, because the chestnut never, the rails never disintegrate, or some of the old cabins before the great blight hit, and I don't know if your viewers know, but there was a tremendous chestnut blight, and it killed all the trees at the turn of the last century, and the only ones that have survived are ones that are in the middle of meadows, way apart from other trees, so the disease didn't get them. Well, that's maybe 10 trees on the East Coast. But you can still find the stuff that was cut before then. So I'm on a mission. Do you know what? You're the only person that's ever brought that up in my life.
I can't believe it.
How about that?
Well, I read something the other day that said there is some progress being made in developing for America a new blight-resistant chestnut tree. But when I thought of it, I have at the moment the crime writer Lindsay Davis from England, who's my house guest. And she lives adjacent to Greenwich Park. Her back wall of her ancient house is the wall of Greenwich Park. And when I was there for Bob Barnard's Diamond Dagger last June, I went for a walk up into Greenwich Park, and it's covered in chestnut trees, and they were in bloom, and those candles, and I see why now they're called candles, because they really, the blossom really is this kind of candle structure. I mean, it isn't just like a magnolia. It's really vertical. And I thought, man, how those mountains must have looked when those trees were all over and those gorgeous things come out. In fact, I read somewhere that said that the Smokies may have been called that for the chestnut blossoms and not for the mist and the clouds. Have you ever heard that?
No, I haven't. But it's interesting that you bring up the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Smokies, because I think it's a perfect environment for a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being, for me anyway, is this was once the highest mountain chain in the world.
Right.
And when you look at them now, you see the power of time. And it really does kind of lift you and get you thinking. And the mystery of time. And then off you go. You're ready to write.
They have been ground down. But, one of the things I love about the area, I read the law in Charlottesville, in the University of Virginia Law Library. So I have read your books, all of them, the mysteries, from day one, because I'm so interested in the area. And spent a lot of time there. And I think the hunt country, because it's not really a very American concept. There's not that much of America that's really hunt country. It's so gorgeous. And you obviously love it.
Yes, I'm a master of foxhounds.
Right.
And I carry the horn for Oak Ridge. And I slept with foxhounds as a child. They were in my grandfather's little house, so I slept on the floor with them. And but the interesting thing about hounds, which will occasionally appear in the mysteries, although Sneaky really wants top billing. She really wants the cats to be the center of the world. In her mind, she is. But you look at the friezes in the Egyptian tombs, people hunting with hounds on couple straps, which are still used to this day. Homer mentions hunting with hounds in the Odyssey. When Henry Hudson came up the river that bears his name, in the Half Moon, he had foxhounds on his ship. Is that amazing?
It really is. In fact, you've written three mysteries about a mistress of foxhounds. I love those books. I was very saddened to see some note in the, here it is, Full Cry, the third one, that it might be the last one.
It really isn't.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
I think that was just a publicity mistake or whatever. because the next one I'm going to do in the Hunt Country is about the Hunt Ball, which is really, I mean, people just carry on like sin, but they're beautifully dressed when they do it. But it'll be a while before I get to that. But it's the great passion of my life, and like all passions, it's completely irrational, and I know I look a fool, and that's okay.
So there's a natural fox population in Charlotte?
There is. There's red foxes
Eastern
and gray
Virginia?
Foxes, and they're a little different. The grays are smaller, and the grays will often run a figure eight. When you're on a gray, you'll kind of know by the pattern that the fox is doing, and they'll climb a tree if they want to. Reds can, but they rarely do. The red will often go in a straight line and then might, you know, do some variations, but they'll inevitably come back to their dens. So, and by the pattern or where you pick up the scent, you usually know who you're on. And they can get away because it's not like you do in England. In England, they hunt to kill, and here we don't. And I don't mean to bash the English. I don't mean it in that way. They aren't brutes. But wool is one of their major export products, and the fox can really kill the newborn lamb. So a fox is vermin to them and has dire economic consequences, where for us it doesn't matter. So
it's a sport, right?
Yeah, we don't need to kill them.
I found it fascinating that you had done these three. I'm bringing it up because I know that your viewers are familiar with your Sneaky Pie series. Some of them may not be as familiar with the fox hunting series, which I have liked really well. Fulcry is the third, and then it was Hotspur was the second, and
yes.
The first one, it's right here, is Outfox. Sister Jane, what an interesting character.
Sister Jane, in Fulcry, is now 71, and in fox hunting, that's not very old.
Is that right?
That's not well, people, their bodies, you know, they might have 71-year-old faces, but their bodies are 30 or 40. Because they ride hard, they live hard, they're mostly in really good shape, and you're out in all kinds of weather, so you're tough. I mean, virus and stuff like that, you don't get it like everybody else. It's because you're tough. You know, you're out the way we used to be out. There's a woman, a marvelous woman, Jenny Moss, who's the master of Moore County Hounds in the Sandhill area of Southern Pines, North Carolina. She's in her middle 90s. She is the master, as I said, and she rides young thoroughbreds that she's bred herself, and she just flies right by you.
Well, I was thinking that maybe there was some autobiographical stuff to Sister Jane. Maybe it's wish fulfillment now that I'm listening to you.
71 will close in fast. I mean, it'll be here before I know it. I don't know where the time goes, but I think everybody watching you doesn't know where it goes either.
But you obviously had experience. I mean, you can tell from reading the books that this is something you really knew about being. Is it master? You're not a mistress of the fox. You're a
master
of the fox. That's a
MFH.
Okay.
MFH behind the name.
And so here's Sister Jane, who is, you know, closing in 70 and then passing it, and she's master of the fox. And I was thinking to myself that really, if you think about it, a fox hunt's just a great place for people to die, whether naturally
yes.
or not.
It's also a great place for people to have affairs because their blood is hot.
Ah.
And there's an awful lot of that.
Well, you have fun with that sort of aspect in the Sneaky Pie books, although it's a little toned down. But, well, I'm pleased to hear that you're going to go on because I think those books are really grand fun. And what prompted you to start a second mystery line?
You know, I wish I could say that I thought these things out and that I plotted it and I was really smart, but I'm not the brightest bulb on the Christmas tree. I just love it, and it's so much fun. I thought, oh, I want to write one and see if the public will be interested. And my publisher was like, oh, yeah, fox hunting, people aren't going to want to read about fox hunting. I said, oh, just do one. Indulge me, and God bless them. They do. I mean, they indulge me by sending me to Phoenix and you, which is wonderful. So they did, and it just did great, you know, and then they did the next one, so I think we're all right. And I think part of the appeal is, so many people live in cities now. I mean, really the bulk of not just our population, the world. And there's a hunger. There's a hunger to reconnect what we once were, to be back to animals, to understand, really understand the seasons, to feel it in your bones. And, of course, if you fox hunt, you do. That's your life.
Sure. I think that the population in the Sneaky Pie series reflects that, you know, your closest animals. You obviously live with kind of a menagerie of your own, or you wouldn't write so lovingly about all these cats and dogs and horses. And
I do. And the one thing that keeps coming back to me over and over again is, you know, first of all, cats and dogs are little predators, and we're medium-sized predators. And when a predator looks at something straight in the eye, they're going to pounce. that's a kill. So predators will often not look one another in the eye. So when your dog or your cat is looking at you right in the eyes, it means they trust you. It means there's tremendous trust. It's the bond. And so knowing that I have this bond and that they feel it for me too, I've paid a lot more attention to them. And one of the things that it's really come forcibly home these last couple of years with the rise of the Christian right. And of course, I don't want to get into that too much because I'll get Tourette syndrome. So we know we're going to die. Animals know when they're dying. They know when another animal's dying, and they will often know when a human is sick and perhaps very ill before the human does. So they have these knowledge, but they don't carry around with them the idea that they will die. They know when it occurs. We know, usually by the time we're five, that we can die. So this creates tremendous fear in the human animal and anxiety. And we've created these elaborate belief systems to soften the fear, to deny the inevitable, in essence. Animals don't do that. We filter all experience through these ideologies, which means we're missing a lot, and in some cases, just plain wrong. The animals see exactly what is. And having that consciousness in a mystery series is a great gift for a writer, because I don't have to pretend. They can say the things that are true that no human would ever say, either because it's too offensive to them, or because they can't see it.
Or it's too, when you say offensive, you mean it's too fearful? Or they're too fearful?
Well, sure. I mean, something as simple as animals call their young. How could you say to a human, call your young?
Ah, okay.
You know, call the damaged. We'll spend thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars to save a little creature that's damaged and ignore 20 that are healthy that could have been sent to college. And we think we're compassionate. Perhaps we are. I'm not arguing the point. But to an animal, that's ridiculous.
Right.
Because there are only so many resources. They understand the concept of finite resources. In America, I don't think we do anymore. I think we're so rich and so satiated that we just think we can go on forever, that there's no piper to pay.
Well, I also don't think we're reinvesting in ourselves, but that's another whole matter. I've just been in Europe for a while and looking at Spain, where they are obviously spending money on Spain, you know, to do things with their infrastructure and all. And I think if you travel around America, you can see places that are crumbling away, but we're not reinvesting in all that. I have felt that that the Sneaky Pie Mysteries, I've never really thought of them as cozies. I don't think of you as a cozy person. have not, I don't want to say darkened, I don't think that's really fair, but I certainly thought in Whisker of Evil, the new one, you know, you're dealing with some pretty tough subjects. You know, you're talking about rabies, you're talking about lots of passions, and of course you're always talking about murder. And I wonder sometimes, you know, if your audience is deceived by the fact that you have these kind of talking animals, you know, into thinking that this is just all cute. But I really think there's a lot of, you know, pretty nature red in tooth and claw and a ruthless quality to a lot of the books. Do you find that your readers get the message?
I think they do. I think publishing just seeks to categorize you because it's easier to sell.
Right.
You know, it's like putting a handle on a suitcase. They don't really care what's in the suitcase. And I don't. They can call me anything they want. I don't much care. As I said, my publisher is very good to me, Bantam. And then Ballantine does the Fox Hunting series. But the one thing I don't do that I think maybe would put me in that cozy category is that I don't go into a lot of lurid sexual detail and all of that. I mean, it isn't that people don't have affairs. They do. It's just handled with a certain Virginia diffidence, if you will. And the murders, you see it. I mean, you see what happens to the bodies, but it isn't sort of lingered over in prurient detail. Like, I don't know if you read the Dante Club, but it opens, and it's just, I mean, the detail is almost lascivious, you know.
So many serial killer books are like that. It's one reason I've developed a real aversion for them. I think a lot of it is just pornography about women.
Well, it's a pornography of death, too.
Right.
I mean, this is a culture that denies death. I mean, we literally want an uncrucified Christ, except now with Mel Gibson, we've got one, right? So whenever something is squelched, as the expression of sexuality was during the end of Victoria's reign, you get pornography. Death is squelched. So now you're getting this sort of pornography of death and violence, 6 feet under, the family plot, if you want to look at it in TV terms. It'll always come in the back door, one way or the other. I don't do that, so therefore perhaps I'm seen as cozy. I just sort of say what is and get on with it.
I think actually part of the cozy thing is because of the cats and the dog, you know, that those are kind of components of an awful lot of cozy mysteries. What was it that inspired you to have a series where the animals talk to each other?
I think they have elaborate communication skills. I don't think I know. Including the prey animals have elaborate communication skills. They have the ability to move their ears and raise their fur and move their tails and literally throw off a scent at will, particularly a fox. And these are communicative. They have a vocal range, and in some cases much wider than our own. So they haven't developed language, yet they understand it. What is it? A seeing eye dog has a vocabulary of about 300 words, and they know the difference between nouns and verbs. Horses have a much more limited vocabulary, but they understand. And cats, we don't know, because they're rather uncooperative about their language skills. But they haven't actually developed the language. We have. And while it's a wonderful tool, it's also become a shield. Because language isn't life. It's simply a representation to try to get ideas together, or people together, to get something accomplished. I actually think it began in hunting, because that was the first cooperative thing we did as a species. But we are now so blinded by the word that we're missing all other forms of communication. We can't even read our own species anymore. Many humans can't even read another human's body language anymore. So we're getting further and further away from being human instead of more and more human.
So is it fun for you to set it up so that the animals are talking to the reader and to each other, and there's that layer going on, and then part of the tension of the book, if you will, part of the suspense, is whether the humans will pick up on what the animals have already figured out?
It's enormous fun for me, and it's a very useful technique. I sort of think of Sneaky Pie's books as, if any of your viewers are Southerners, in the summertime, you get a delicacy called seven-layer salad.
Right.
You've had it.
I have.
You know, and each layer is like, you know, ice-cold peas, and then cheese, and then you'll get some lettuce or arugula or whatever, and then you'll get maybe some egg, but there are layers, so if you cut into it, it's like the earth, you know.
Right.
So I always kind of think of these novels as a seven-layer salad. There are some people that will get all seven layers. You know, when they read it, they'll get the whole thing. And there are others that they may only get the first two, but they've had a good time.
That's a good point. When you say Southern, you were born, what, in Pennsylvania?
I was actually born almost on the Mason-Dixon line. I was born in Hanover, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
My mother was working at Hanover Shoe Farms. It's the largest standard breeding farm in America, in the world, actually. And her water broke, and the closest hospital was Hanover, Pennsylvania. So by rights, I'm a Yankee instead of a Marylander, and my father's family was from Virginia. But nobody in the family ever lets me forget this.
Fun. So you actually are a Virginian, because I read that you had lived in Florida, grew up in Florida or something. I was trying to work out
junior
the
high and high school.
Okay.
We went down there when it was really pretty primitive. There wasn't air conditioning yet in most of the buildings. And the Miami Herald was the biggest building in Florida. It was six stories high.
Uh-huh. Do you think of Florida as Southern in the sense that you're defining Southern?
Yeah, I do. Underneath it all, Florida is more reactionary and backward, I think, than any other southern state, including Mississippi. I actually think Mississippi's fabulous. But underneath Florida, there is something so remote, and also the fact that they never really made peace with the Seminoles. I think that peace treaty was finally signed within the last 20 years. The treatment of the Seminoles, because I saw it. I was right there with it. And then as the wave of Yankees came in, the Snowbirds out of Wisconsin and Michigan and all these places, what I saw, and not all of them, of course, but it made a vivid impression on me, because released from their communities and their restraint of cultural control, I mean, in a way, their racism ran riot. And I always felt that black folks and then later the Cubans got a more raw deal in Florida than anywhere else.
How about gays in Florida?
Well, I don't expect they were cherished. But I think Florida's God's waiting room, so maybe it'll all...
Well, Arizona's a little bit. I mean, it's an interesting thing. You know, people from the East Coast and some Midwesterners go to Florida, but most Midwesterners go to Arizona.
I would say that's a wise decision.
I grew up in Chicago, and you could sort of see the split. But I often think when I'm in Florida, radio, I think. This is like the Bronx and New Jersey, you know, kind of put together their idea of some wonderful.
But if you can get away from all that and get into the Everglades or get into northern Florida, because most of them don't like northern Florida, you know, or the panhandle, what we call Floribama, that's still pretty wonderful.
It is nice. I love Tampa. I think that's a gorgeous area. And my uncle for years owned property on Amelia Island, which is just above Jacksonville.
Yeah.
And I like all that part, and it's quite different. But what took you back to Virginia? Because, I mean, I know you think of yourself as a southerner. I've read things that, you know, where you talk about.
Well, I mean, my father's family got there in 1620. In fact, they lived through the Good Friday Massacre of 1622. And I loved it. And as a child, my mother would take me down in the summers, of course. It was a train ride down. And for whatever reason, I liked it a lot better than where I was, or maybe it was just the romance of it, because I remember we went and sat on Dolly Madison's grave when I was a little girl, and so I felt like I met Dolly, you know, and my mother would take me to, and my mother didn't like history, but she realized that I did, and so she was very loving that way, and she would suspend her pleasures to make sure that I got mine, as long as I would go to the shed rows of Pimlico and Laurel with her and gather information on the horses. So we worked out a deal. So she would take me, and I saw Mount Vernon, and I saw, Miss DuPont, she married Randolph Scott, but she was still living in Dolly Madison's house when I was a child.
Was that at Ashland?
That's Monroe.
That's Monroe, right? It's around the mountain from Monticello. Right.
None of these things were really prettied up yet. Mm-hmm. You know, there was some restoration of Monticello. I mean, that was further along, and also with Mount Vernon, but the others were sort of a little shabby. In fact, in some cases, very shabby.
Right.
And Poplar Forest was pretty much left to go to seed.
Yeah, Ashland was the first time I saw it. It was just barely, you know, anybody was doing. Now I think they have an elaborate music festival there and all kinds of stuff.
Everything.
But I remember it as pretty tacky.
But see, that's what I loved as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sort of stirred all these romantic notions of what it must have been, you know.
Wonderful. And, of course, it's around from... I've always thought the University of Virginia was really the great representation of Jefferson. I mean, I think the Serpentine Walls and the, you know, the quadrangle and the whole bit is just so wonderful.
Well, he thought so, and on his tomb, president isn't there.
That doesn't
come first. I think it's, there's three words.
It's the Declaration of Independence, the Statute of Religious Liberty, and the founder of the university, or the architect, whichever he said, of the University of Virginia, were his three proudest achievements. And you're right, he never mentions being president.
And I love that. And that's also very Virginia. Very Virginia.
Well, it's a wonderful and romantic country. So when you were a kid, what was the pressure on you to be Southern? You know, were you...
No. No, the pressure on me was to say incredible instead of bullshit.
That didn't work out too well, did it? Yeah, but, I mean, were you brought up to... Because, I mean, I spent 20 years in Virginia as always an outsider. You know, I'm from Chicago. My moment of truth was in 1958 when I graduated from New Trier High School. I had a choice between going to Smith College, which I rejected because it was still only women then, and I couldn't see there was a lot of point in that. I was 17 and full of hormones. I could have gone to Duke University, but they were having actual race riots, and when I went down to visit Duke, you know, on that invitation sort of thing, the women's campus at that time was still separate from the men's campus where the beautiful church was and the whole bit. They were taking women students back and forth every day to class under armed guard on buses. And I thought, you know, I'm from Chicago. I don't think this is what I want to do. So I wound up at Stanford. And I always thought it was kind of a joke that years later, there I was back in Virginia in law for 20 years. And I knew it was time to leave Virginia when in Ashville, just up the road from Bristol, the county seat there. Going blank.
You mean in Avalon?
Abingdon. Sorry, in Abingdon, there was a suit filed that was Scopes Revisited. It was a suit about whether or not you could teach Darwinian, you know, evolution in the school. And I had spent several years in a book discussion club with some really intelligent women who lived in that part of the country. And at that moment, didn't matter about, you know, all the years we'd spent discussing Leibniz and Nietzsche and everything else. At that moment, everybody sort of lined up by whether they were Baptist and, you know, and the whole bit. And once again, it was just like going back to Duke, you know, in 1958. And I thought, I don't belong here, you know, I mean, because I really can't get into this lawsuit. It was so bizarre. So I came to Arizona, which is probably where I belong.
But I can explain Virginia to you.
Well, I'm sure you can, but the whole time,
first explain Virginia, okay, as my mother would, and then I can tell you how it is for me. My mother, who was a Marylander, whose family also got there in the early 1600s, and there is this ferocious competition between Maryland and Virginia as to who's the better state. And poor old North Carolina, you know, because South Carolina also has a very high regard for itself. You know, here's North Carolina, sea of humility between these two mountains of conceit. And I remember my mother at one point when there had been some discussion with her mother-in-law, who she didn't like, she turned to me and she said, "Oh, honey, one out of every four Virginians is mentally ill." And she said, "Think of your three best friends. It's not them, it's you." And I always, that stuck there, that, "You're right, Mom, we're all nuts in a way." For me, it's fine, because the South cherishes its eccentrics.
Yes, it does.
As long as I have good manners, which I do, I mean, all those years of cotillion,
right.
I mean, I do have them when I need them. So I'm well-mannered, and so they kind of take a charge out of the other things I do, because I'll say what they're thinking, but I'll do it in a funny way.
Okay.
And the fact that I'm in the middle of them, and of course, since we've been there since the 1600s, it allows them to think they're more liberal and tolerant than they really are.
There's a sort of an emphasis on gentility, I think. Maybe, you know, when you say good manners, don't you think of it as that sort of...
I do.
You know, I think gentility is a word you don't get to apply often, but if you're going to apply it, I think Eastern Virginia, Charleston, South Carolina, maybe are two places where it really factors in.
Well, and it shows up in the sneaky pies a lot, and also
yeah.
in the hunt books, because there's an elaborate dance that you learn as
exactly.
a child. And you learn it as a child. It's so difficult. You truly learn it as a child. The ways in which you deal with people and how they're, you know, it's like those Russian dolls where you keep taking
right.
the doll apart. And you get, that's what Southern manners are like. You finally get down to the real thing. And Northerners, it's funny, Northerners are direct. They want the information. They want to know. Time is precious.
Exactly. I was always too fast for everybody.
Yeah.
I could see people visibly wanting to slow me down.
Because what we want to do is dance.
Right.
It's the dance of community. It's the dance
and family too.
Yeah.
There's this incredible blended family thing, you know. And I mean, I love that in Whisker of Evil. I particularly liked it because you have, you know, all these things going on with Big Mim and Little Mim, and you've got, you know, are Harry and Fair, you know, are they really going to, you know, kind of coalesce again? And it's like a big cotillion. It was sort of fun, you know. But I was thinking about it as here's Rita Mae, you know, she's kind of writing these steps in this cotillion, and all of them were sort of forced into the dance.
Well, and also the ways in which you get revenge in the South are very elegant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might plot it out for a long time, but it's elegant, and there's no fingerprints. You learn to be a safecracker. You leave no fingerprints, but it does lend a certain ease to life. And the other thing about this, which I think people from other parts of the country may not be aware, is this isn't about race. The dance of manners, it's everybody. You can be as poor as a church mouse. You can be illiterate. You can be African American, whatever it is. But everybody gets the manners. And if they don't, it's a terrible stain on the family. It really is. It's worse. It's worse than being gay.
Aha. Okay. Well, that explains quite a few things to me. I appreciate that. The Whisker of Evil, you have done, that's your 12th sneaking?
Right. 13
it's actually Mrs.
Cookbook.
Murphy. You know, it's easy to go wrong here and think that Sneaky Pie is the name of the cat the book, but it's really Mrs. Murphy and the gang. But anyway,
it's the 12th, but there was a cookbook, so it's
right.
really 13.
And I was going to say, it was 12 novels plus the, is it the Sneaky Pie
yeah.
cookbook for mystery lovers? Is
yeah,
that the title?
That's it. You got
which
it.
Which is really good fun. You've done the three fox hunting books. I regrettably have not read all of your other works, although I have tried. I liked your Dolly Madison book. I brought a copy of it along today because I wanted to ask you about why you wrote that one. I thought that was great fun.
I think if Dolly and James had not been married to one another, we might have lost the country.
Ah, during the war there?
I think it was such a bitter and brutal time. The New England states had gathered to secede from the Union at the Hartford Convention, something they rarely teach you in your history books because there was a precedent for secession.
That's true.
And the only thing that saved it is they voted to secede because their trade was being ruined. All those good old New England shippers, you know.
It was what, the British embargo?
Yeah.
I mean, the blockade?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't able to get their goods out to Europe, and they didn't really give a darn. So they wanted to secede so they could still do business with the enemy, so to speak. And they passed it. And a few days after that convention, remember, it takes information to reach.
Right.
Andrew Jackson won the Battle of New Orleans.
Oh, that's right, he did,
right?
Didn't he?
And their careers were cooked. That was the end of those political careers. And they couldn't deny they'd been at the convention.
Right.
You know.
But it had become moot, actually,
yeah.
hadn't it, by the Jackson. What was that, 1814?
1814.
And then the treaty, was it the Treaty of Paris that ended that? I think it was in 1814.
And these two, here was James Madison having to prosecute a war, which he never wanted in the first place,
right.
forced on him by the Young Turks of Webster, Calhoun, and Clay.
And it was called Mr. Madison's War, which was there on
fair. He hated it.
Right.
And he's married to a woman who's a Quaker, who's against war and against slavery. You know, and here he is, a slave owner, which tortured him his whole life, actually. And they held together. It was a very sexually exciting marriage. It was a very intellectually exciting marriage, too, even though there was, 17 years between them, I think.
Was that that much?
It was a big gap.
Yeah.
And he was not a very impressive specimen. He was a little fellow.
He was little, wasn't he?
Skinny.
Right.
Not very handsome. And she was a babe.
Right.
She made men crazy. And they held together, and they got through this dreadful time. And I think had he been married to a weak woman or someone that wasn't willing literally to die on the steps of what was then called just the President's Mansion for that Constitution and Declaration of Independence, I'm not sure we'd be here.
So she was an exciting person to write about.
She was exciting. Also, she saw her mother stand up to one of Tarleton's raiders during the Revolutionary War. They came up the James River. And Tarleton, who was actually a marvelous officer, sent out raiding parties all up and down the James and was torching that part of Virginia. And looking for Patrick Henry. Because he was a traitor and they wanted to hang him. They wanted to make an example out of him. Well, Dolly's mother was his cousin, Patrick Henry's cousin. So she had taken the house that he'd rented. Was just trying to keep body and soul together because her husband, Dolly's father, just couldn't rub two nickels together. I mean, he was useless in terms of money. And one of these raiders came up, a colonel with a whole regiment behind him, came down the long farm road, his sword brandished, and calls out, "Give me Henry." And she says, "He's not here." The mother says, "He's not here." And she had hidden the children in the back with the nanny, who, of course, was a slave, and a servant. They didn't believe in slavery. They were Quakers, but she was black, and in essence, I doubt she was paid very much. But Dolly snuck out and snuck into the house and was down the hall and saw the colonel ride up the steps, draw his sword on her mother, and saw her mother defy him, not knowing whether she would be killed or not. And the mother looks up at the colonel and says, "He's not here. Get out of my hallway. Look what you're doing to the wood because of the horseshoes." Was cutting into the wood. And the man was so undone that he hadn't terrified this woman. And furthermore, she was talking to him like his own mother. He turned around and rode off. And I often think that Dolly fulfilled her mother's courage in that moment when the British were literally three blocks away from the White House, and she wouldn't go. She said, "They're going to have to kill me." And it took two men to drag her out.
She was an amazing woman. Absolutely true. Were we lucky in our founding fathers?
I don't know if there will ever be a constellation of such intellects or spirits again, including the women they were married to. Abigail Adams.
Right.
What Martha did for George. I mean, she never gets any credit. And she did everything. She was, in essence, running a corporation, that big farm.
Absolutely
and
true.
And keeping
if there
on.
Was a man who could have been king, and, you know, it never seemed to occur to him that, you know, I mean, you really think about what he could have had if he wanted. And,
Hamilton.
And rejected.
All of them.
Well, Hamilton, I've always thought that was, I'll never forgive Aaron Burr. I'm really still ticked off about that.
And the funny thing, it's funny that you bring that up, and it's one of the things that kept coming to me in this Dolly book, is John Tyler was the last, I guess he was the 10th president, was the last who knew these people fairly well. And when he died, many people said, it's a new generation now, and they're out for themselves. And then that was the generation of Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, where the ego, even though they were brilliant men, the ego was everything. Whereas these men certainly had egos, but were able to put it in the service of a great cause. And if you think about it, from that time to today, we've had very few public servants, particularly as president, who were able to live up to the founding fathers, not just intellectual example, emotional example.
I think that's true. And also with that custodial view, Harry Truman may have been the only one in the 20th century who really understood that it was the office. And, you know, there's a famous line about him when he left the White House and went back to Missouri, and somebody interviewed him and said, you know, what was the first thing you did, you know, when you went back to Independence? And he said, I took the suitcases up to the attic. That was it, you know. It was so, he really did get it, you know, that it hadn't been about him. Mm-hmm. Although he had some fiery moments in office, nonetheless, he let it go. And I think that's been very difficult for other presidents. And I've always admired that about Washington, that he did the two terms and he let it go, went on home. And I've often stood in the court, many times I've stood in the courthouse in Richmond and tried to, you know, imagine that trial with, you know, John Marshall and the whole bit. I mean, Richmond is a fabulous city.
Well, the State House was one of, I think it was Jefferson's first public commission. It's very, very simple.
It is simple. And then you go to Charlottesville and look at the university, and I mean, it's just all drenched in history. But you're right, it does give you a feeling like you're walking in the footsteps of giants.
But if Dolly and James were to come back today, I think there are many things that they'd be very proud that we've done right and that we've carried on. And I think there would be other things that they would be repelled to the marrow of their bones at the self-indulgence, the crudity, particularly the crudity, and the continual enriching oneself at the public trough.
You know. Well, we've become a confessional society, and you know, and one in which actually misdeeds are celebrated, and that was not... No literary discussion with you could possibly be complete without asking you about the Ruby Fruit Jungle. You wrote that in 1973. Was that your first book?
No, it was my second book. I had two books of poetry and a book of political essays, some of which I'd written when I was 18. But Ruby Fruit was the first novel, and I got $1,000 for it. Nobody would publish it.
Big advance.
Yeah.
Was Molly kind of a you character?
No, but Gloria Steinem said that, and it sort of stuck. I mean, sure, we have some things in common. We both grew up in the country, and we're both a little bit insouciant, if you will. But I think Molly, in many ways, was a much nicer person than I am. Because I can lose my temper. I can have my fiery moments, like Truman, too. But she was an interesting character because, in a sense, she very early learned who she was and accepted. And that's so hard for people. I don't care what their sexuality is or what their race is or whatever. For whatever reason, it's so hard for people to accept who they are.
Well, yeah, it is. And also to do it young. I mean, I think as a teenager, that's a really tough. So many people seem to be much older before they ever get to grips with it. You know, figuring it out. I didn't know who I was, but in a different sense. I mean, I always knew what my sexual orientation was, but I didn't have any real idea what I wanted to do until I was actually in my 40s. Who knew? I think it's because I had too many things I could do. I think I was spoilt for choice.
Huh. Maybe that's true of a lot of people, but I just sort of look at them and want to say, you're perfect. Why are you worried? You're perfect. You know, if you want to go out and be an external success, okay, you have to make a series of decisions to do that. But you as you, you're fine.
I'm not sure that being brought up in the 50s was a tough time, I think. I'm older than you are, and there was a lot of pressure on, I think, girls particularly in the 50s to sort of fall into that Donna Reed image, you know, and if you didn't, it was tough going. And it was not my undergraduate experience. I look now, I've been back to my 40th college reunion. I cannot tell you how difficult it was to be a female undergraduate at Stanford University in 1958. All the cards were stacked in favor of the guys for a whole lot of reasons. They had fraternities but not sororities because some political's daughter had committed suicide during Rush and they weren't sure how that went. You lived in segregated housing and you couldn't have a car. And you had no social structure, so the only way that you could sort of escape from it was to either have a steady boyfriend, whether you wanted it or not. And, you know, it's not that it was overtly miserable, I don't mean that, but there were a lot of odd pressures, and it was sort of hard, at least for me. It was a very transitory age, because I can remember demonstrating against TWAC, I think, in 1960. Some of us went up to San Francisco, we all got washed off the courthouse steps, you know, when there was that. So that was the end of the McCarthy, you know, thing, and we were heading into Vietnam. It was my first husband then died. later. So it was a very odd time in American history. You know, we'd come off World War II, and we'd gone through the 50s, and we were, you know, clearly a world power, and, you know, there was this sort of huge image that had been sold to us by television and other things. And then, wham, we went into the 60s. My husband, who's quite a bit younger than I am, is a child of the 60s in a way that I can't understand any more than he understands me as a child of the 50s. We often talk about that. And when I say quite a few, it's actually only 6 years. But you know what? It could be a whole it's a whole generation.
Well, it is, because quite a few of my friends are in their middle 60s, early 70s, because like I said, Fox Centers never get really old.
Right.
And their view of things is very different than mine. Not that we don't agree politically, often
right.
We do, but many of them, particularly the women more than the men, still have an anger at being, feeling they were held back and belittled and diminished, and in many ways they were, but I often look at it, because I was, of course, the generation that fought back, I'm on the other side of the Grand Canyon, and I said, yes, but there were also rewards you had that I'll never know.
Well, that's true. I'm not angry, I was just confused. And as I say, spoiled for choice. And I think it would have been, you know, if I hadn't had so many possibilities, maybe it would have been simpler. I always wondered, how did people know? How did you know when you were 16 that you really wanted to be a writer? How did you know, you know, you were going to be a nurse or, you know, whatever? And I used to look at people who had almost like vocations, you know, among my friends at school, and I think, how do they do that?
Well, don't you think some vocations show very early?
Apparently.
Usually a gift in the arts shows when they're tiny. The same with athletic ability. It shows up so early. And some children come into the world wanting to heal.
Hmm.
You know, they really want to, you know, they'll start healing their little pets or putting splints on them or whatever, and they may wind up in medicine. And then there are others that it'll be a stroke of luck or a gift from the gods, and then they'll know.
Or a seminal moment. Now, you had an interesting educational background. You have a PhD in what, political studies?
I do. I got my undergraduate degree in English and classics, and I will say to the day the good Lord yanks my chain, is that if you don't know Latin, you don't know English. You just don't. And why would anybody want to be a writer without having the tool? And then I went on, and I, you know, did more work, and then I finally got my PhD in political science. But really, what it was still classics, because I used Aristophanes' The Birds as my. thesis, and in the sense that I said writing has always been political since the beginning, and so then I had to go defend my thesis, and I would never do that again. Why I did it, I don't know.
Hmm.
That PhD piled higher and deeper.
But did could you foresee what kind of writer you were going to be? I mean, what was it that sort of fell out of you? I mean, you're a writer now of, you know, commercial fiction, good commercial fiction. But did you think you might have gone differently? Maybe you'd been an academic, or
I could no more be an academic than I could fly. I couldn't do it.
Yeah,
it's too. If I'm going to have that kind of infighting and pettiness, then I want to be in a Fortune 500 corporation when I take home a really big paycheck. I'm not doing it for what they get. I'm not. And that they're fine, they're wonderful, and they get 2 months. But I really don't like the academe very much. I didn't know what I was going to do so much, but I knew I had this great underpinning. I had this great foundation because of the education that I'd chosen. And what I wanted to do was write simply. I wanted to use the English language that I thought at its highest and best manner and use it in a way that nobody was aware that I was doing it. In other words, I wanted to be invisible. I wanted the people to jump off the pages at you, as though you'd have been invited into a party, or that you knew them. They breathed. You knew when they'd eaten mints that day, so to speak. And I think sometimes when people make a great big show of how smart they are, they're actually weakening their books, because character is plot. Character is fate. I mean, Heraclitus said it long before I did. And it's all about character. The animals are character. They have character, as do the people. So that was my great big push, and I didn't know where it was going to go, because when I was young and started writing, oh my God, everybody was still imprisoned in existentialism. I mean, when that load of crap came over the boat from France, from Camus and Sartre, they should have just dumped it in Boston Harbor like they did the tea, because it ruined a generation of American writers. Just all a twitter with alienation, you know, and aloneness, and not knowing, and is there a God? And I'm like, oh, for God. God's sakes, Mary, get over yourself. But that's me. I'm right. Pretty basic. I'm a farmer, remember? And I knew I would never do that. Or be these guys that wrote these big fake butch books, you know.
Right.
You know, where adjectives are, there are a few of them, but they're always very manly, you know.
Muscular bros.
Oh, yeah. And when they see a woman, the first thing is always about her, you know, her physical attributes and can they do this and can they do that. I mean, you know, the guy that writes it is probably, you know, his neck is like a pencil, you know. And it's talk about wish fulfillment. Real men don't talk and write like that. My God. And I knew I'm not going that way. Sort of the Mickey Spillane school of, although Mickey's good. I mean, he's actually good.
No, he is.
But his imitators have really damaged
And, you know, it's hard to take that away. I mean, after Silence of the Lambs, there were a whole lot of, you know, really bad imitators. Right now, Da Vinci Code is just spewing up, you know, a whole bunch of imitators of that kind of thing. Whenever there's a huge hit, it happens. But here you are with 12 books, and you've created really this sort of community that's obviously very real to you and must be very real to your readers. It's kind of like an ongoing soap. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got, because it's a small, Crozet, Virginia is a small southern community, you don't, you know, you bring in outsiders. I mean, you have to, or you lose all your credibility. Someday you have to bring in strangers to die, or it's all going to go away. But you still have this essential cast. And, you know, we've watched them kind of get to know themselves and move through life and make mistakes and coalesce into new relationships, and on it goes. And you've also kind of written about how the landscape has changed. I loved your comments about I-64, how it had divided the farms in Albemarle County, and particularly about the mountain, because I have struggled up and down that damned mountain in all that fog. That's the highest fog technology, road fog technology, is built into that mountain with all those pop-up lights and the whole bit. And they can't conquer it, can they? No matter how good the road, they can't get past the fog.
Nope.
But I really love the way you write about that. And even in this book, where you've got the new post office, and Harry has to decide how she's going to deal with, you know, a whole shift in postal technology.
And she's a young woman. She can deal with a shift. What she can't deal with is the emotional shift.
Right.
And Crozet is changing. I mean, in real life, Crozet is changing.
Sure it is.
Money's coming into it because it's a fairly nondescript town, which is why I like it. There's nothing cute and gentrified about it. But it's changing, and poor Harry's sitting in the middle of it, and what do I do now? I mean, and the one thing I like about Harry, which I don't share with her, is that she doesn't know. She doesn't have a clear vision of what she wants to do with her life.
Or who she's spending it with.
Does she really love this guy, or doesn't she? And he's all she knows, really.
On the other hand, maybe she doesn't know him. I mean, I thought that was part of the message of this book, was that maybe he isn't exactly the person she's thought he was.
Well, he isn't. And what happens sort of in the one that Sneaky just finished is she comes upon a revelation, and emotional revelations are very hard for her because she's very repressed, as am I. She realizes that he and Boom Boom have done the hard emotional work because of their mistakes. And she sort of likes Boom Boom now, but not too much. Mm-hmm. This is the woman that her ex-husband had an affair with. And they have changed and really learned from what they've done, learned about emotional damage to others and themselves. She hasn't.
Well, you still got lots of books to write, so, you know, it'll give you material.
Do you think anybody whose IQ hovers above their body temperature could ever run out of material?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. I think that a lot of series have a natural life. The author loses interest, and then the readers lose an interest. So it really depends on how your interest level goes as to whether this series, you know, carries on or not. It really does. It's in your hands.
Well, that's a good answer. I never thought of that. I just figured as long as you're breathing, you're surrounded by stories.
You are, but, you know, but it doesn't work the same way. You know, I spend my life talking to writers, and I promise you it's different for all of you.
Huh.
It's so fascinating. Some people are like one-book authors. Some people can write, you know, nothing but one kind of book. One of the things I think so interesting about you is you've done so many different things and done them all with passion and conviction. You know, obviously really enjoyed them.
Well, you know, working with the English language is like living inside this gorgeous cathedral.
Well, that's a wonderful metaphor, or so similar.
Oh, God.
It's a simile. Sorry, I remember now. I'm going, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to be embarrassed here. I learned my English from French. You know, I think you're right. You do need one of the Romance languages, and I learned it sideways. one final question, because we're out of time and I have to wrap this up, but I've been wanting to ask you, Sneaky Pie, I mean, is this just a device, or does your cat actually give you input, however she does
it? Oh, she's there. I mean, she's actually right there on the desk. That, well, they all are. I mean, the whole zoo shows up.
But why did you, I mean, do you give her co-author credit, you know, just sort of for fun? Is it?
Actually, no, I watch her very intently. I
mean, you do.
Sure, I'm cute, and the books aren't cute, and the animals aren't necessarily cute in it, but I really do watch this animal and watch the others and keep, I don't know, your viewers might not want to hear this, but I actually learn more from animals than I do from people.
Well, I think that you've said that a lot in this conversation. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
And I'm closer. I connect more readily.
Yeah. You're a farmer. I mean, you said that, you know, that you live with your animals and you go through their life cycles with them and all. And I think that that's very clear in your books and it's what makes them so interesting.
And the one thing I would say, and before the time runs out, is the one thing that has so humbled me in this series, because I've looked more and tried to study more, is I really believe that some of these species, particularly dogs and some cats and some horses, I think they have a capacity to love more deeply than we're capable of.
I do too. I mean, I have a dog, and I can promise you that, you know, that unreserved love that we get from Casey is just, it's incredible.
I don't know why we're so selfish.
Maybe we're too complicated. Maybe that the language, you really mentioned that, maybe language gets in the way.
Maybe it does.
Yeah.
But I just look at them and I think, I want to be like you, you know?
Well, I don't want you to be like them. I want you to be exactly who you are, because I love what you read. Rita Mae, thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
It's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and instructive as well. And I certainly thank all of you for joining us on this episode of The Criminal Calendar. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.